This episode of Developing Courage is brought to you by Minds in Motion. If you and your family are struggling with the development of one or more children, find out about their four-quadrant program for kids K-12 at mimlearning.com.
You're listening to Developing Courage. I'm Kara Vonderhyde.
And I'm Lauren Thomas.
We just spared you some outtakes.
Yes.
We started over. We got the giggles there for a minute. But we're back. And welcome to this episode with Amy Ryan.
Amy is a friend of mine. She's a physical therapist that I work with. But she is also a mom of 5 children at this point, 2 of which were adopted internationally. So we're going to have her in today to talk to us a little bit about that process. And what that looks like for her family.
Yeah, this is of interest to me. I have a niece and a nephew who are now in their early 20s. One of them, the youngest one, is still in her teen years, but they're both in college. They were adopted internationally from Korea many, many years ago. And recently, I had some friends that adopted from China. And hearing both sets of parents talk about the process of adoption so long ago to modern day is quite fascinating, the difference in the training that parents get now versus what they got then. So I can't wait to hear what Amy says.
Absolutely. And we would like to thank our sponsor, Minds in Motion, for sponsoring this podcast. Minds in Motion is a fabulous organization that works directly with clients, but also trains educators and parents on how to incorporate movement into everyday experiences to help kids with their learning.
Absolutely. And if you need their help, you can give them a call off their website and use the code word podcast for $100 off an assessment.
Great. So now it's time for Kara and I's red light,
green light. So my green light, which is something that we've been talking about, I give this the go ahead.
Okay.
It gets my green light. I was at a course a couple weeks ago, and the course instructor, who there was one from Chicago, one from Pittsburgh, one from Missouri. So they were kind of all over the place, and they travel to give these courses. But she mentioned something called a junk playground.
Oh, what's
which
that?
Which apparently has been popular in Europe for quite some time. Started as a Scandinavian thing, spread to Germany and other parts of Europe.
Those IKEA folks.
And yeah, the developers of, maybe they have IKEA junk there.
Maybe.
Who knows? After their people are done with their desks and their bookshelves, right, they put it on the playground. No, they're also called adventure playgrounds. I consulted Dr. Google, that's doctor with a PhD in this case, and it said junk playgrounds are basically places that people put their junk, think tires, old statues maybe, logs. If you consult Dr. Google PhD yourself, you'll find some pictures of to give you a good visual of what I'm talking about. Nothing sharp, obviously, nothing.
Right. Safety, you know, considered.
Safety considered. But what fascinated me about this course, what this course instructor had to say about the junk playgrounds, is that it really gave an opportunity for more open-ended play. Versus, you know, you and I have talked a lot, both personally and on the podcast, about our current American, North American playgrounds can be very sterile, and they can not often give really strong opportunities for movement and the development of the movement system sometimes, but they've taken a lot of stuff off of playgrounds for liability and safety reasons compared to when we were kids.
Absolutely.
And back to the junk playgrounds, it gives the kids an opportunity to move and test their skills in a way where they develop the critical skill of risk analysis. Without their parent hovering over them, they get to decide how much is too much. You know, maybe I'm trying to drag this log across the junk playground, but maybe I need some help. Introduce social skills. You get a partner to help you, and they can build things and just move and play. So I propose that we have a few more of those in this country.
Absolutely.
And we get away from the sterile playgrounds while still offering our children proper supervision, because we don't want brain injuries or, you know, any serious injuries coming out of this. But I do applaud that idea of giving kids the opportunity to assess their own risks, because that helps them as a life skill.
Absolutely. And as therapists, I love this idea because of the motor planning that's involved and how you have to think about using your body or using equipment differently to complete a task.
Right. And even if we don't have a nationwide movement to get a lot more junk playgrounds anytime soon, you can do this in your backyard. Like, I have extra tires that I've collected in the backyard. We do have logs that the kids have used as balance beams and pool noodles and things that other people might say, I don't want my yard to be quite that junky. The kids will get a lot of use and development out of that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. Well, I have a red light.
Okay.
So this is a personal red light, but I think we're probably all guilty of this at some point.
We should stop it.
We should stop it. So it's been summer. We've been out. The sun is shining. I mean, here in Louisville, Kentucky, we're at the very end of the Eastern time zone, so the sun doesn't go down until 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night at the height of the summer. So it's really easy to lose track of time. You go to a party. You're having a great time. Suddenly it's 9:30. It's 10 o'clock. Sun is going down. And you realize, I realize, that my two-year-old is still up and right. still playing. Maybe a little bit fussy, but she's having a good time because she's with all her friends. But that little warning light goes on that we are now 2.5 to 3 hours past typical bedtime.
Sure.
And I'm pretty much doomed for the next day mm-hmm. because I've thrown off her routine for the sake of having a good time. And it is really hard to leave an event that you want to stay at. But it is so important for kids to have that routine and that bedtime. And when I put her down at 7:30 or 8 o'clock, she sleeps great. She's a great sleeper. She doesn't get up till 8:30 or 9 the next morning as it is. But if we don't do that, she's still getting up at 8:30 or 9, but she's really tired the next day and fussy and extra irritable. So it's just not worth it.
That's not good for anybody.
No. So anyway, we are looking forward to having Amy in the studio and hearing about her adoption story. Enjoy the show. So today in the studio, we have Amy Ryan. Amy is a friend of mine and a colleague through work, but she is here today to talk as a parent of children that have been adopted, and she's adopted 2 children internationally. So welcome to the studio.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your journey to adoption, what led you to go down that path, and how you were able to adopt those beautiful children of yours.
Sure. My story is a little bit different than a lot of people that I talk to, because it was not driven by infertility, which a lot of families are drawn to adoption because of that. However, probably when I was 16, I went on a work trip with my church and didn't know exactly what I'd be doing, but ended up in Honduras working in an orphanage, helping to build it up, and just got to experience kind of what life is like in an orphanage for kiddos. And, you know, at 16, I wasn't thinking about planning my family, but that just planted some seeds for me. So I always just considered that that might be part of my story. And when I was dating my husband now, at the time we had talked about, yeah, foster care adoption might be something we'd like to do. We got married and we started our family pretty quickly and pretty easily. And we had 3 kids within 3 years. And so life was pretty crazy. So the adoption thing kind of got put on the back burner. And just over the years, we've had friends that have adopted, and it kind of rekindled our desire and our talking about it. And then finally, we just kind of had a discussion that, you know, if we're serious about it, we need to do something, because there's age limits on different places, as well as we're just getting older and it's harder to parent the older you get. So that kind of turned us to say, all right, now if we're going to do it, now's the time.
As parents, we focus on the day-to-day development and well-being of our children. Minds in Motion can be your partner in struggles with hyperactivity, homework, frequent meltdowns, frustration, and other situations that are keeping your family from thriving. Get to mimlearning.com to read 10 signs of struggle and sign up to learn about their 4-quadrant program for kids K through 12. Minds in Motion has locations in Louisville, Kentucky and Carmel, Indiana. If your family is struggling with development of 1 or more children, contact Minds in Motion and start solving the problems today. mimlearning.com.
So you make this decision that you're going to go down this adoption path. What do you do from there? What's the first thing that you all did from there? I know you said you had friends that adopted. Did you reach out to them?
We did. Absolutely. That was probably the first thing we did, and said, you know, we see all the great stories and the smiles and the pictures, but what, you know, what's the reality behind adoption? Because, you know, we know that there can be difficulties that come along with it. And so we just had some friends who were willing to be honest and genuine with us and say, here's some of the things that were hard for us. We heard a few stories that actually changed our mind for a little while. Some families that just really struggled with attachment issues that just changed the dynamics of their family for a while. And us already having three kids, we felt like, you know, this just isn't a decision for Drew and I. This is a decision for our family. And so we decided, you know, let's just take a step back for a little bit and consider if this is what we really want to do. So about 6 months later, we got together again to discuss the topic, and we both said, you know, do you still have a passion about it? Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do. Are you still scared to death? Yep, sure I am. Me too. But ultimately, we decided our faith was what was a big part of that was driving it, and if we came to the decision that we would have the help that we needed to get through it. So meeting with families and talking about special needs adoptions, because we knew that's what we were going to do. And then I guess figuring out where we were going to adopt. We never said, oh, we will always adopt from here or there. We're always open, you know, domestic, international. And kind of researched countries and places, and there's a lot of different rules, like I said earlier, on the ages that you have to be when you adopt, the size of your family, finances. The trips are different for different countries. And we ended up choosing China. One reason was the amount of travel that it required. It's one trip to go to China to blend your family, and you might be gone two to three weeks. In some of the other countries, it's a couple of visits, and sometimes it's a month or more duration while you're there. And just considering what our family already looked like, we felt like that would probably be the best situation. So we decided on China.
To go back to your decision to, I don't know if you call it a sign up or, you know, do we accept a child with special needs? Do we not? Can mm-hmm. you elaborate on that thought process a little bit? Because I understand, you know, there are a lot of different factors in that decision, but one of them might even be timing for some families. Is that correct? As far as waiting a long time or not waiting a long time?
Yeah. Well, I can speak really just specifically to China on that aspect. But for China, I know one of the families that traveled with us had been on a healthy child wait list. And I think their wait was 7 to 8 years at this point. So they had been waiting.
Going through that now.
It's a long time. And actually, their child was one of the sicker babies of all the rest of our kids had some form of identified special need. And when you sign up for a healthy child, you think you're getting a healthy child, but these kids are still coming from orphanages, and as good of an orphanage can be, it's still an orphanage. And she was just malnourished. She at this point has caught up and is doing wonderful. But at the time when we got all our babies, you know, the healthy child that they'd been waiting 7 to 8 years for, you know, was really ill. But our decision on special needs was based a lot because of my experience as a physical therapist. I just felt like, you know, we're going to welcome another child into our family, and I know how to help in a lot of ways physically. Why would we not do that? We considered what our current home is like. You know, if we end up with a child in a wheelchair, does that change anything? No. You know, it's manageable. It didn't scare my husband off. But you fill out this several page medical checklist of things you think you might be able to handle, things that might feel like are too much. And you just say, here's what we'll sign up for. You can change it at any time. And then they begin to match you based on how long, you know, you've had your checklist in and how frequently kids come up with those needs. And then they say, here's a kiddo that kind of matches your profile. You know, want to look over it. You want to have specialists look at it, your pediatrician. You can't really ask a whole lot of questions and necessarily get answers back from China. Like, when you go to a doctor here, you get all the tidbits. So there's still always going to be a lot of unknowns, but it does kind of direct you toward some identified things to be aware of. So,
did you work through an agency?
We did. We worked through an agency that's based out of Colorado, but now they also have a location here in Louisville, Chinese Children Adoption International, and they are one of the largest and longest standing adoption agencies for China. They're a Christian-based adoption agency, and one of the things that I really appreciate about them is that they're not only finding families for kids who are adoptable, but they also are caring for the kids who are being left behind. There's many care centers, there's facilities that are doing teaching and training for the nannies for, you know, development and preparation for the kids as they grow as well.
What were some of the things that the agency had you do to prepare for adopting?
One of the aspects was parent training. You had to have 10 hours of parent training, and they had a online courses that you could take at your leisure, and you had to pass them. And some of the topics were, now again, this was just for China, so it might be different for different ones, but grief and loss in adoption, talking to your child about adoption, several sessions on just attachment, child development, being a multicultural family, several about Chinese culture to prepare us for, you know, what the heritage was, and just about special needs and older child adoption.
As a physical therapist, you obviously have a different perspective on some of that information. Did you find it to be thorough developmental information and special needs information?
Yeah, it was excellent, actually. It was really good. Part of the gap, though, comes when you're trying to choose a child and it feels like this huge decision, is there's just so many unknowns. We adopted two children at the same time, and they have two completely different backgrounds. One, we had a diagnosis that we were acceptable to, but absolutely no medical reason for that diagnosis. We had a current weight, height, and head circumference in a very short, small video, which wasn't necessarily very, very revealing. The other child also came with a diagnosis, and he had been cared for in a care center where an American charity had been involved. And so when he was 2 months old, he was sent for surgery. He had rehabilitation. I have all his MRIs, surgery reports, pictures of him from the time he basically was arrived there at like 20 days old. So, you know, that kind of information is helpful to bridge the gap on what you see in a diagnosis and what is the reality. But many, many of my friends are coming home with kids who have a diagnosis, and they're probably diagnosed to the best of their ability there, but they're inaccurate diagnosis. Most of the time, it is diagnosis that are healed or better, or they don't qualify for that diagnosis anymore. There are some that things were unidentified, and so when you bring your child home thinking one thing, you know, there are some other issues medically that you weren't aware of.
Well, and as you mentioned before, even whether or not you have a specific named diagnosis, a lot of times their lack of developmental experience in the orphanage itself may lead to sensory processing problems or
Absolutely.
Just mobility problems. True.
Very true. And they actually, in some of the training, they prepared parents that for every 3 months your child's in an orphanage, you can expect a 1 month delay. So our child who came home just after turning three, we were expecting about a 2-year-old developmentally. So that was a good gauge for parents to think, not only size-wise, because all the kids who come home size-wise are much smaller, developmentally, what you can expect with, you know, language development as well as sensory processing and motor milestones and fine motor milestones, what, you know, what to expect.
What about for your children? Preparing as a family of five to adopt two children, what sort of things did you do as a family to prepare for that, or did the agency help to prepare your children for that?
We had done, because we knew, have known for a long time, that's something that we're interested in, we would just kind of randomly bring it up with the kids. Hey, what would you think about this? Or what would this look like? Or how would you share a room if this happened? So some discussions had already taken place. So it wasn't necessarily a huge surprise when we said, we're really starting to think about this. But we just had a lot of family discussions on, you know, how are you feeling about this? And this is how it's going to change our family. And pretty accurately, we were pretty sure that our youngest child, who was the baby for 10 years, would probably have the biggest transition because she then would become the middle child. And she has, but being aware of that and knowing how to speak her love language to her so she knows and feels appreciated and loved was really important. And I forgot your question.
Oh, I was. What did the agency do anything in particular?
Well, part of the process is a home study, which is a social worker who comes to your home. They have to have access to all your finances. They have access to interviewing. They interviewed my husband separately, me separately, us together. And then she talked to each of the children kind of to get a feel for what they were thinking about it. So I guess in that aspect, that opened the door for somebody else who knew what they were talking about to kind of assess where our kids were and identify any concerns that they had about it.
Did you have a lawyer through all of this, or does the agency kind of, they have a streamlined system and they just walk you right through it?
It's like a machine. You just jump on board.
Yeah.
They walked us through everything. And literally when we were in China, filling out obscene amount of paperwork and going from place to place to turn it in and get our fingerprints and have pictures. Like, I was blown away at how detailed it is of a process because they did so much for us. And I thought, you know, the people who did this first must have been really, really determined because we think how hard it was. Oh, we had to leave our family. Oh, we had to, you know, raise funds. Oh, we're over here for 3 months. I don't know how they figured it out. I'm so thankful that they did, but it was a big process in the agency. I mean, they just tell you what to do and you do it. And there's a timeline that helps you prepare and very guided on, you know, every step of the way.
And as far as China, or I would imagine there's agency people on both sides kind of guiding the training and the whole streamlining of the process?
Yeah, there is, in the offices here in the States, they're fully staffed and they help with any questions you have. They do preparation for pre-travel on a conference call. They help with the paperwork. They overlook the paperwork. They send the paperwork to China. And then in China, we had no less than two guides with us from our agency the whole trip. And we were in three different cities during the process of our trip, about a week at each place. And they were with us, or we had access to them 24 hours a day. They stayed in our hotel. They helped us and some of the other families that had kids were having a difficult time, kind of bridge the gap with the communication and just the abrupt change in their life that they just have had experience with doing this for so long. So they cared for us from the time we said, yes, we want to adopt until we left China to come home. And then they also do follow-ups to make sure you're doing okay. They have support groups online. So they're just not worried about getting a child to a family. They want to make sure that's a healthy process for the child and for the family all the way through, you know, coming home.
And since it's a requirement with China right now, at least, I don't know if it's always been this way, that you go there to pick up your child, correct?
Yes.
Because my niece and nephew, they had transporters,
yes,
that transported them over from Korea. My brother and sister-in-law didn't have to go. Even if they wanted to, they couldn't, I think. But while you were in China, do they kind of guide you through some purposeful heritage activities while you're in that country that you can
That's a really great question.
Of remember?
They do. The work that you do in your 10 hours is so much information, so fast, and so much longer before you actually go to adopt. I mean, it was good baseline information, but once we got there, they spend a couple of days touring with the families before you get your kids, so you kind of can concentrate and take in the culture. We went to, you know, the Great Wall of China and Forbidden City. We went to downtown, like old China. We have amazing pictures that we'll be able to share with our kids, showing them hands-on, you know, things about their culture.
You know, that kind of answers my question.
Yeah.
we were talking before we got started, there's a family that we go to school with that has had a very similar experience in picking their daughter up in China. And it sounds like, you know, they did the same thing. They got traditional dress over there that they could bring back with their daughter and kind of absorb into something that they could show and do and the older children could be a part of. And
I had heard of another adoptive family do this, and I thought it was such a great idea. We got 18 gifts for the kids to give to them every year on their birthday, something that will be from China that they'll get to open. But also, yeah, we got traditional dresses that we brought home for our, well, and the boys' outfits too, for our other kids. Pearls are a big thing, so we bought pearls for weddings in the future. Jade is another valued stone that there's some traditions of the mother and the father each wearing jade until their child gets married, and then they present that on the wedding day. So there's some things that we will intertwine, you know, into some of our traditions that we hope that they'll appreciate.
They'll appreciate it.
Well, right, because again, I'm thinking back to my niece and nephew, and because they didn't have the opportunity to go to the country itself, they had to kind of do all that here in Louisville, which isn't quite so oriented to the Korean culture.
No, and there's just not the same as actually experiencing it yourself. You know,
they sent a few things with the babies, but...
Yeah, we should hope to share that with them. And also our agency has called preteen and teen... I forget what it's called, but it's for teenagers, adopting is what it's called. And they do like heritage trips, and they take the kids back to China to some of the, you know, main highlights. But it's a way for them to connect on a level of, you know, we're all experiencing the same thing. We look Chinese, but we've been brought up American. What kind of, you know, controversy has that brought to your life, or how have you struggled with that? And they have somebody who can identify with them and ask those honest questions and not feel maybe ashamed or embarrassed. And we really felt like that was a benefit of getting two kids together. We hope it is for them, that they will feel, you know, maybe not alone. Not that in getting one child, you know, they would feel alone necessarily, but just to help them to feel connected. And we knew as we were getting older that we probably wouldn't go back, even though we would want to. So we went ahead and tried the process to get two at the same time.
I can so appreciate that. Just as a child, an American that grew up in a foreign country, you know, I refer to myself as a third culture kid. You know, when people ask where I'm from, I have to take a big pause and go, well, let me talk about that a little bit, because I spent 9 years of my life in Singapore. And, you know, what you identify as yours and part of your heritage is very different. So I love that that opportunity is there for them.
Well, adding that into just the dealing with being an adopted child in and of itself.
Absolutely.
I mean, I certainly don't know what it's like, but in watching my loved ones go through that, it really does add another layer and level to what you're dealing with. I think those trips sound great.
So talk about the attachment piece, because I know as a therapist working with families of, you know, that have adopted children overseas, that's always a big thing that comes up as part of this transition, is that attachment piece. How do you feel like you were given instruction on how to help with all that?
The parent training was helpful. They also recommended some resources that we read before we went. The Connected Child is a huge one that's always recommended. I think I just had some foreknowledge about it, so it just seemed to flow kind of naturally. But we knew that kind of going back developmentally to some bonding activities would be, whether they needed it or not, or it was perceived to be needed, there are some things we wanted to start. So even though they were 3 and almost 2, we took bottles. And for that connectedness, we bottle fed them at night. They hadn't had a lot of exposure to a variety of foods anyway, so really their main nutrients, even at 2 and 3, was from formula in the orphanage. So we knew that was something that they really wouldn't turn away from, and it gave us the opportunity to attempt to snuggle and bond with them. Now, the day we got the kids, we probably got them maybe half an hour apart from each other, and our son came first. And we kind of had a plan that we would each kind of trade off. One would take one, and the other would kind of embrace the other one when they came. Well, the other one came so quickly, we kind of were taken off guard. And I took Elizabeth, who was older, and she just was scared to death, didn't know what to think, didn't know what was happening. Probably people she was familiar with are not the people that brought her, because they come to a civil affairs office. And her orphanage was probably about 2.5 hours away. Levi's, it was in this, it, right in the city where the civil affairs office was. But Levi came to me. He looked a little bewildered, but warmed up quickly. And he was attached to my side pretty much from that moment. Elizabeth calmed with Drew, and for the first whole week, he met every single one of her needs. She really did not want me to hold her. She, by the end of the week, Drew went on a touring event, and I just didn't want to go. I wanted to stay home with the kids. And that was the first time she kind of was forced to interact with me. And her first nod of, okay, you may do something with me, was I was sitting in a chair holding Levi reading a book, and she, with her back to me, backed up until she hit my knee and just gave me a small look over her shoulder as if to say, okay, put me on your lap. I want to read the book too, but I'm not giving you eye contact. And it grew from there. But the going back to doing a bottle feeding was helpful. It's interesting when I talk about wanting to hold and cuddle them. They were not used to that at all. They were put down and went to sleep. Elizabeth had bedmates from the best that we can tell from the time she'd entered the orphanage until she left. So she was used to sleeping right next to people. So that's been a little bit difficult for her.
Did they prepare you for how the children might react and kind of what to not take personally versus, you know, your natural nurturing mother wants to do all these things and how the kids may react to some of that?
Absolutely, they did. And I think one of the, well, the nice supports too is just like a Facebook page that's created. I'm sure each agency has it, but you know, before you travel, you're already connected to the people you're going to be traveling with. And everybody goes through different struggles during the trip at different times. Some kids attach quicker, some didn't, some eat, some wouldn't. So aside from like the head knowledge of what am I supposed to do if they do that, you know, there was people actually going through it with you. Try this, try that. You know,
how many would you say?
We had like 7 families traveling. We were the only one getting 2. So, my mom traveled with us and another lady's mom traveled with her. And aside from that, it was all couples. One couple brought their previously adopted daughter with them on the trip, which was really fun. So there was the support of like the family, if you brought any, but also the family that just the group. We shared this experience. I mean, we'll be connected forever. You know, we all shared taking pictures of everybody when their child came in. You know, it was very much like the birth process. Like, oh, this is it.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, and I'm wondering how much did you know anything about what the children were told, or do you not get that information? Like when Elizabeth is getting ready to be put in the van when she's 2.5 hours away, ready to come meet you, what did they tell her?
I have no idea. I don't know if she knew. We were able to send the kids care packages. We sent some clothes and teddy bears and a little blanket and a photo album of trying to explain this is going to be your new family. Pictures of all of us with Chinese words on mom, dad, brother. So with Levi, I feel like he was probably pretty prepared. I also feel like he had the chance to attach to people as he was going through his first, you know, 22 months of life. Elizabeth, I'm not so sure. Just due to the different kind of experience they had in the orphanage, there's so much we don't know.
When you're 2 and 3 mm-hmm. years old and you've never lived outside an orphanage, they may not even have a frame of reference for that, right?
No. Yeah, I'm sure not. I'm sure not. I don't know what she, you know, I wonder, what did she think when she saw those pictures? You know, did she recognize us? She came with a small little bag that she didn't let go for probably 24 or 36 hours. She kept grasped in her hand, and it had a few stale snacks that they sent with her and the clothes on her back, and that's what she came with. So I don't know, except that she was pretty shocked.
Mm-hmm. And how long did you stay in China with them before you traveled?
About 2 weeks.
So yeah. You're there about a week, and then you blend your family, uh-huh. And then you're there another 2 weeks before you come home.
One last week, and that week is spent where the consulate is, because the kids have to get passports and visas and stuff like that. So that's the process of, you have to go back to their home city, you have to get pictures. You know, it's a paperwork issue. And as soon as that's done, then you can leave. Otherwise, we could have come right home. But it was good. We had struggled with the idea of taking our kids, first three kids, with us on the trip, because we wanted them to experience it. We wanted them to know what the heritage was. We wanted them to see why we cared so much about giving a kiddo a home who otherwise might not ever know a family. You know, why do we care so much about that? And there's families that take their kids, and I think that's wonderful. But ultimately, we decided not to. It was just Drew and I and my mom. And I'm glad that we did. I mean, I see the benefit in just us going to have that time to, because they had to know, you know, we are your mom and dad. Talking about the attachment, another thing was that we were supposed to be the only people who gave them food or a bottle. Any only ones to give them comfort if they were upset, you know, and maybe the attachment would be different if we had everybody and they were being handled and passed around between the kids and stuff. I don't know. We'll never know. We just go with the decision we made, and our kids have attached super well, and they are doing amazing. So we're just going to go with that.
I know you just said that you were the ones that were supposed to meet their needs. Did that include your mom, or was she supposed to stand back a little
bit?
She
had to stand back, and for the first couple of days, I saw on her face how hard it was. She just wanted to scoop them up. But they barely wanted us, let alone another person. You think, oh, it's grandma, and you want to share that. But they just weren't ready for it.
Sure.
And by the end of the first week, she kind of started to do a little more and a little more. But we were the only ones who did the bottles. Probably at the table, it was when we were having meals, it was really difficult. They had no table manner, you know, little toddlers to begin with, but throwing food, having chopsticks, tossing silverware, you know, all this food. They didn't know what to do with. They'd never seen it before. It was kind of crazy. So it was so nice to have my mom there to kind of help just manage the logistics. But so in those times, she probably was helping out with some food, but in the changing diapers and going to the bathroom and the bottle feeds and stuff, we did all that.
And to reassure you. You know, yeah. Sometimes you probably wanted your mom a little bit to go, it's going to be okay.
That's right.
You know?
You could do this.
Yes. So, not to play this down, but, you know, people talk about it's too expensive to adopt a baby. You know, we want to do this, but it just costs too much money. So, don't do logistics, but just talk a little bit about how, you know, that became very feasible for you.
Okay. It is extremely overwhelming. To think about the finances. And had I not had people who had gone before me and figured out ways to do it, I might have struggled with that more. But also, I think part of our personal faith perspective was, you know, if we are being called to this, then we're going to be carried through this in some way or another. And the way was always there at the right time. It just really grew my faith, just the financial aspect. Probably you could consider, just for generals, an adoption, whether domestic or international, could be anywhere from $24,000 to $40,000 for a child. We applied for many grants. We were accepted for two grants. We did as many fundraisers as we could. We did a t-shirt fundraiser. We had a carnival. I sold necklaces. I went from working part-time to working full-time for a year to prepare not only for the financial burden of the initial adoption, but to be able to stay home full-time to really build in that attachment piece for a year after we came home. So, you know, the adoption community, it has grown fast. And once you reach out to that community, it's also like just like a family. And there's people to spur you on with different ideas and help you. Like, lots of people are having garage sales, just take up donations of stuff people don't want to have a garage sale for, and have a huge garage sale, and all the benefits go to the adoption. So there's things that you can do. Now, it does take time. It's not just going to fall in your lap. It comes at a sacrifice of time and effort. But if it's something that you feel passionate about, then it's something worth pursuing.
Well, and I would think that living right now, when online selling and fundraising, you can reach so many people kind of beyond your own
Absolutely.
Circle of influence, would make it a little bit easier. If you're techie does. Like that.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're techie like that.
Well, I followed your journey on Facebook. I mean, that was one of the ways that we could all kind of keep up with where you were in the process and when you went to China. And,
yeah.
You know, those first great pictures. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it was, and all your fundraisers. I mean, yeah. That was, you used that as a great tool.
Yeah. So the price of the adoption is simply to, I guess, get the family or get the child into your family. I'm also thinking about, like, or does that incorporate the travel costs of you going over there? Or is that something separate when you're making the decision, you know, for just you and your husband and your mom to go versus all of the kids? Or is that something that's also kind of wrapped up in the fundraising?
Well, I can tell you specifically with our adoption through our agency. So it's going to vary some. And you can do that research before you even choose an agency. They have, you know, this is how our funds are broken up. But typically, it does not include travel. So, you know, you think $25,000, $28,000 for just the adoption process. And then on top of that, travel funds. Yeah.
So... now you've blended your family. You've come back to the U.S. You now have 5 children. So talk a little bit about that transition, those first couple days or weeks, what that kind of looked like for your family and things that, you know.
I don't remember. It's a blur. Honestly, the jet lag hit me way worse than I had anticipated at all. Like, I literally struggled just to keep my eyes open. Now, the timing was really good because... well, and I have to say, we're so thankful to have family who came and stayed with our 3 kids at home because they still were in school, so we couldn't send them anywhere. And we had 3 different people who came those different weeks and stayed with our kids and got them to school and made sure they felt included and would Skype with us. So we've had support there and at home when we traveled. But
well, I'm sure the adrenaline,
how like we blend?
Yeah, once you get home, I'm sure the adrenaline of everything happening kind of goes, oh. And no wonder you're exhausted. I mean, you're exhausted because the time zones are different, but you're also exhausted because you've been on this huge emotional journey.
So emotional. And when we left to come home, we had transportation issues, so we were going to be delayed, and we ended up flying in Chicago and then had to drive home from there. We didn't get home till about midnight. We were hoping to have one of these great airport greetings, and I envisioned my husband and I each having a kid and our 3 kids running to us in the slow motion big group hug. We just drove straight home.
Elizabeth, the best laid plans.
Yes. Elizabeth and Levi had never experienced car seats before, so it was about 3 hours of screaming. Because in China, there's no car seats, and they just had freedom to stand up and look out the bus windows and taxi windows and thought that was great, and they were not happy about car seats. So, and when we got home, you know, we wanted our first 3 to just, like, scoop them up and know them to the point that we'd gotten to know them yet. And even with my mom on the trip, they warmed up to her, but not really completely. But when we got home, it was almost like a flip switch, and they're like, oh, okay, this is where I belong. And within 40-45 minutes, they were on our oldest son's back taking pony rides and stuff. And they wouldn't talk to the Chinese people when we were in China. They didn't talk to our guides. Like, they were with us, or they weren't going to be with anybody. And so initially, that was pretty cool and neat. And so the big kids went to school, so I was able to be at home with them and rest when they were resting. And it was trial and error and figuring out language and building the communication, figuring out what, you know, what doctor's appointments do we need to start making, kind of looking ahead on what all those things would look like. So there was never really any downtime to catch up. It was, you hit the ground running and it hasn't stopped.
How could it stop with 5?
Yeah,
kids?
I don't know. No, it doesn't stop. It's a merry-go-round.
Yeah. It won't stop. Can you describe that moment of connection? Because in following our friends' online pictures, and you know, it was just fascinating to me because at first they didn't have a specific person, but they thought it would be a daughter, you know, and you heard about their daughter's out there, and then they had a person and they had a name to go with the person and they knew where she was, and then it's just, you know, such excitement for this person who for such a long time was still across the world who they've never met. Can you describe that moment of just when you knew that you were their mother, I guess?
I feel like it was a little bit different for each of them. Because Levi, it all had to do with the ease of attachment. And for the families who have children who really struggle with attachment, I think it's got to be the hardest thing in the world, because you can give out as much love as you can pour out, and not to feel like they're accepting that would be one of the hardest things to go through, I think. So we started off saying, you know, we'll sign up for two, and if it happens, great. If not, we want a son. If we get two, we'd like a son and a daughter, or however it happens, we'll take it. So we didn't really have anyone specific in our mind, and then we got matched with Levi, and we had his picture. Then we got matched with Elizabeth, and it was the weirdest dichotomy of, you have a name, and I'm calling you my son and my daughter, yet, so there's this connection of, I've wanted you and I've thought about you, yet I don't know you. And it's very strange. And in the days leading up to us leaving on our trip, everyone was so excited for us. And all everyone could say is, you must be so excited. It's finally here. It's been so long. You must be so excited. And I didn't say this out loud to anyone, but I was scared to death. It seemed like a crazy adventure that it took a while for some people around us to be like, okay, this is a good idea, maybe.
Right.
So I didn't really want to share my fears, but I was scared to death. What if I don't like them? What if I feel like I can't love them? What if they don't blend into our family? What if they ruin our family? What have I done? You know? And honestly, some of those fears are the same as when I had biological children. It was, sure, was like, okay, tomorrow's the day the baby's coming. You know, how is this going to change our life? And it was the same experience that way. When Levi came and he attached to me, I pretty instantly felt like it was meant to be, and no doubt about it, this is my son. Elizabeth, I was really worried about her, about what was going on with her. I worried about the darkness I saw in her eyes of absentiness. But it so quickly, it felt like it quickly transformed into the relationship that it is. And I think it helped because I knew to expect that, that it would come, and to just give it time. I think that helped me. So when I think of the moment of getting them both at the civil affairs office with Levi, like, that was my moment. Like, here he is. Like, I was just handed my baby. And with Elizabeth, I instantly was heartbroken for her because of the stress she was going through and how difficult I saw it was for her to go through. And I knew, you know, this is going to be okay. It's good that she's grieving. She has to go through this. This is part of the process. And I'm like, that is so unfair. Mm-hmm. That is so unfair that she has to experience this. And that made me want to fight for her even more, I think, for her to warm up. But logistically, handling both of them, like, if they had both only attached to me, it would have been so hard. Like, it was almost divine, you know, that Elizabeth attached to Levi. Elizabeth attached to my husband, Drew, and Levi attached to me. Like, that first week and a half, it was so manageable for us to take care of their needs and for them both to feel like we were giving them 100% of our attention.
Well, that's great perspective about the attachment can happen with your biological children as well. Like, it's really not much different, because yeah, I had that with my second child. It was difficult to get to know her. She screamed all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm thinking,
but you work
about,
it out. You work it out.
You do. I'm thinking about, as a therapist, I've worked with some of these families that have adopted, and the struggle that some of the parents have, because you're working on a skill, and you know as a PT as well as I do that sometimes they don't like us very much, and they're getting upset, and they're looking to the parent. And that you can see the parent struggling with, wait, I'm supposed to be working on attachment and comforting them. However, I need them to work on X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
So what a nice perspective you had to, you know, find that balance between those two things.
Can you talk a little bit more about what you enjoyed or what you gained from reading The Connected Child? Because that's a book that's come up in the therapy world for me. Mm-hmm. Obviously, as therapists, we might see a lot of kids that have been adopted just from that, you know, lack of early development experience that causes delay later when they get over here, whether or not it's international or not. And then I also have a friend who did not adopt internationally, but within this country, who's done a a whole lot with it. Like, she found the author, and the author came and implemented these school programs down near Nashville. And
very cool. Well, what I can say about that is that I read the book, and I was like, these are things that I'm already doing with my children that are struggling with some sensory issues. And I didn't, the first time I read through it, I'm like, this doesn't have to do with just adoption at all. Because it was so good on just the sensory perspective and giving of, you know, what you can expect and this might happen because of that. And what does a tantrum look like? And how can you head it off? And why might it be going off? And things like that. So I found it to be an extremely rich book. But I think it's more for not only the adoption world, but just for kids who are maybe struggling in general.
Mm-hmm. We'll be sure to link that right below this episode if anybody wants to find it.
Absolutely.
What would you recommend for anybody who maybe before they listen to this episode kind of had an inkling or a tug to find out more, or that this may be for them? I know families who sometimes it's the younger siblings that start the pull and the tug, you know, for the family to grow. So what resources would you point people towards, to kind of decide if this is for them?
An easy one is just going, you can also link our adoption agency. Sure. And I'll give you that information, because there's questions on like, is this right for us? Some good questions to think about. I would say connecting with somebody who's gone through the experience and speaking with them is the best thing to do. And I can be glad to leave my email address for people to contact me directly, but there is a large adoption group here in Louisville, so it would be pretty easy to find someone to connect with.
Great. Okay, so we are going to now go do a 180 here.
It's the Minds in Motion Name That Vestibular Apparatus Show.
We have a game show portion. And Amy did not know this was coming.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So we are sponsored by Minds in Motion.
Okay.
So our game show is called Name That Vestibular Apparatus. So what I'm going to do is read you some descriptors and then give you a multiple choice.
Okay.
You give your best answer, and then we will link the correct answer on our Facebook page when we release the podcast.
I'll tell you, you're at a definite advantage being a physical therapist.
Yes.
Because imagine the people who come in here who have no medical training whatsoever.
Right.
Or I could be more embarrassed than the average person.
All right. Are you ready?
No, but go ahead.
Okay. This vestibular apparatus is a muscle within the ear. It's a muscle. You should know this. Right. Its role is to dampen sounds.
Oh, wait. I brought sound
such
effects.
As those from Same chewing. Thing. Oh, wait. We have a sound effect here. This muscle is dampening that sound.
I saved some of my chips.
It plays a role in auditory processing. Oh, my goodness. And when activated, it pulls the malleus medially. Is it A, the tensor fascia lata? Is it B, the tensor tympani? C, the extensor hallucis? Or D, the stapedius? These are all real muscles for those of you that are listening to the show.
I have a pickle, too.
She has a pickle. She could continue the sound.
I want to hear that crunch.
Yeah.
And then I want to hear slurping from the straw.
Our producer is going to die when he edits this episode, by the way. Sorry, dear. My husband.
So, do you need them again?
Or
do you
have either B or D.
Okay, so Amy is guessing either the tensor tympani or the stapedius.
Stapedius.
Do you want to think some more? Or
no, I don't remember.
Okay, so Amy is going with either B or D. She is not an OT. PT's, you know.
Was I wrong completely to narrow it down?
Okay, so tune into our Facebook page when we release the podcast, and you will find the answer to this question.
Woo-woo.
So we also have one last question we ask everybody that comes to the show.
All right.
And that is, what gives you your courage to do what you do every day? What gave you your courage to go on this journey?
That's easy. My faith.
One word.
Yeah. I think that's a great answer.
Sums it up.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Say what you want to say. I want to see you be brave.
This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only and should not be construed as therapeutic or medical advice, as your particular situation will vary. If you have concerns, please contact your local healthcare professional. For more information and additional episodes, visit Kara and Lauren online at developingcourage.com. And thanks for listening.